Do not attempt to change the channel.
All media are extensions of some human faculty.
Is books part of the media?
Media, we don't need it, do we?
Baby, this thing is bigger than all of us.
The media. A lot of you out there probably never even heard of the word.
Media is any form of communication. It can be radio, television, computers.
Welcome to the internet, my friend. How can I help you?
You know, we live in the most mediated society in world history. You spend 10 to 12 hours a day with media. And so I think it makes sense to think about, in a sort of systematic and sustained way, our relationship with media.
Hello. Hello and welcome to Be the Media. You're listening to CHLY 101.7 FM here in Nanaimo. On this show, Be the Media, we talk about, well, all things media. And we go from the local to the global, and we include perspectives of both consumers and producers. All of the contributors of this show, Be the Media, are faculty, students, and friends of the Media Studies Department and Media Research Lab at our very own Vancouver Island University. I'm Marianne Vanderzon, and I'm joined today in the studio with Neil Scobie, Joy Googler, and Robert McCourty. We've got a great show lined up for you. We are going to start off with a live interview with Robert McCourty. Robert McCourty is the artistic director of the Cowichan Folk Guild, and he'll be speaking about the many element of putting on a music festival, specifically the Islands Folk Festival. And that is happens every year for the last 27 years out of Providence Farm in Duncan. We're going to move then to an interview that with Books and Bites, and Joy Googler is interviewing Michael Price, and they're talking about e-books. And we will finish the show today with Robin Davies' further excerpts from The Oral Machine. Do feel free to contact us with feedback or any story ideas. You can reach us at bethemedia@viu.ca. You can also phone us anytime you'd like on air here in the studio. The number is 250-740-1017. We'd love to hear from you. Know, too, that we podcast the show. You can listen to the podcast at your leisure. Simply go to chly.ca, go to the podcasts, and you'll find Be the Media in the list. We've got a great show ahead. We're going to get things started with a track from Mary Gauthier.
His wife Wanda by his side. He caught the westbound out of here, up the high, and soon by and by. They say he jumped 10,000 trains, rode a million miles for free. Helped out at VA hospitals and penitentiaries. Dandy Dave, rusty nails, and sweet lady, sugar cane. Kate and the baloney kid, raise a cup tonight in steam train's name. Senators, congressmen, puppets on the string. Among the windswept vagabonds, steam train was the king, the last of the hobo king. The last.
Welcome back to Be the Media. I've got a great guest in the studio today. I've got with me Robert McCourty. Robert has been a musician for 35 years. He has a major in psychology, and after spending 15 to 20 years in the software industry as a marketing consultant, he turned back to his first love, which is music. He has spent the last 10 years producing, recording, and playing music. Many of you would probably know him best from the band The Flying Accusations. They've been playing up and down Vancouver Island for the last 5 years. The last 4 years, Robert has been the artistic director of Island's Folk Fest, which happens every July out of Providence Farm in Duncan. Robert, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Let's start. We just played a track from Mary Gauthier, Last of the Hobo Kings. And it was a request of yours. And I know that Mary played at the Folk Festival last year.
Yeah, she did. It was an honor to have her here. She'd never played Vancouver Island before, so it was a joy to have her here. And she certainly made a lot of fans with
she
her
did.
Style of music. But that particular song is a testament to the non-media days where hobos used to hop trains and go from place to place to hobo jungles and play music with each other. So I thought it was appropriate for today.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know they even had their own language, so hobos would actually enter a town and they would know whether it was a friendly town or a friendly home or whether they would give food and that kind of thing. It's a fascinating culture unto itself.
And that particular song is about one of the last hobos that was on the road. And when a hobo passed away, they would say he caught the southbound. That's the way that it would describe it. He's caught the southbound.
As he was leaving town. Let's jump back to the Couch and Folk Guild, and specifically the Islands Folk Festival. How long has the Folk Festival been happening for?
Well, this summer it'll be our 27th year, believe it or not. And that's pretty incredible to pull off any type of event. But, over a quarter century now, we've been trying to bring music and community together at Providence Farm in Duncan.
And you've been doing it really successfully. It's quite large.
Yeah, it's limited infrastructure-wise to a certain size, and we don't want to get any much bigger. We just want to get better.
So just to give folks a sense, I'm sure that many listeners have probably been to one of the Islands Folk Festivals in the past, but for those that haven't, how many stages, how many artists, how many, what are we looking at? How many people come to the festival?
Well, it's held on a 110-acre ground. At beautiful Providence Farm, which is now a therapeutic community. There are 6 stages. There's usually over 150 musicians performing throughout 3 days, starting on Friday evening and all day Saturday and all day Sunday. There are workshops. There's a children's area completely dedicated to the kids all weekend long. There is a healing arts tent that has those types of events running in it, and it's just such a family-oriented event, but it's a very good emotional experience for everybody for a weekend because we don't have a backstage area, so the musicians have no choice. They can't hide back there. They just come out and mingle with the rest of the crowd.
I agree with you. Yeah. I've been there. I've played at the festival as well, and it is just a phenomenal experience.
Yeah. Feeling.
It's great. Yeah. I will say my favorite festival actually out of any I've been to.
Well, thank you. Had a lot of people say that.
Yeah. So all of this, to pull all this off, 6 stages, 150 musicians, this requires a lot of organization, of course, and a lot of people. So what are we looking at? How many volunteers? How many paid staff?
Well, I wish there was more paid staff. That would help. There's just myself and one other person, Emily, who's our office administrator. But the Folk Guild is a volunteer organization and volunteer board of directors. And when the festival comes around, we usually gather about 300 to 350 volunteers in 30 different categories, 30 different components, everything from camping to kitchen to maintenance to green team, environmental stuff. And so they all have coordinators. So there's 32 coordinators and then crews underneath those that really do the bulk of the amount of work during the festival weekend.
Yeah, it's huge. So this is a show on media, so I want to focus on media a little bit. So thinking about it from the perspective of also the sound people, because there's a lot of sound people involved with 6 stages, and, there's also visual components, there's marketing components, promotion. Are those all volunteers as well?
No, the tech crews are usually paid.
Okay.
a lot of the other people, like stagehands and stage technicians, are volunteers though, as well. It takes about a year. It takes a complete year. As soon as one festival's over, we start working on the next one. It's that involved and that intense to use that many people. There's negotiation with artists throughout the year. I have people booked for 2012 that couldn't make it this year, but I want them there
right.
next year. So there's that component. That takes a lot of work. There are contracts, legal contracts that need to be sent out. You have to procure everything because basically you're putting up an entire village for 3 days, so you have to procure quotes from everything from porta potties to just washing liquid.
Right, right. Okay, and so from a media perspective, what are some of the elements involved?
Well, we use just about every form of media there is, and now we're having to use even more than we did in the past. I mean, we'll use radio for marketing purposes, radio, television, and the internet, of course. We try to the music itself is there, is mm-hmm. CDs. You know, I currently have about 1,200 CDs sitting on my desk from submissions from people. So that's a lot of media that's being used out there by the artists trying to apply for the festival. And when you know, extrapolate that.
This is an interesting segue. What do you look for? If you've got 1,200 CDs, how do you make your choices?
There are a lot of factors, actually. One is, where are you from? That matters, because if I have to add transportation costs or, you know, those type of things, then that matters. It's not really your skill level. That's not what I'm looking for. We give everybody a chance from the youth showcase stage right up to the full-blown, you know, big name acts, per se. But we always try to incorporate a certain degree of regional musicians within there, because we don't have to go much further than Vancouver Island to fill up the festival with musicians if we really wanted to. For me, I'm looking for the flow. What style of music are you playing, and how can I fit that style of music into the flow and the atmosphere of the festival? You might be a technically perfect musician. You might have, scads of knowledge. You might have a PhD in music. But if you're boring, like watching paint dry on the stage, then I'm really not interested, because I like to try to get the audience involved with it too. Mm-hmm. So the flow is very important aspect.
Well, and you're successful. You know, I mean, it's just kudos to you, because there is a fabulous flow to the festival that works.
Yeah, stage scheduling is the hardest chore I have. It really is, over 3 days. Like, who's going to follow who? What kind of mood is the crowd going to be in on 8 o'clock on a Saturday night? Are they too quiet? Are they too loud? Can I pull this off by putting this funky band in here instead of over there? Yeah, there's a lot to consider.
Yeah, anticipating that is challenging. And then, of course, I'm sure a lot of times it works, but sometimes I'm sure it doesn't.
So far, so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so you were talking a little bit about using media, and I'm sure that, of course, you've been using traditional forms of media like radio to promote the festival for a long time. So we're in a very changing world, and social media has really become extremely prevalent. Are you using it a lot, and how does that fit with your uses of traditional media?
It's more, I believe, a radio, unfortunately, has become less and less effective for us to get the word out. I don't know why. I believe the usage of streaming and internet and podcasts, that has helped a lot. I mean, that's helped radio to get the message out there, because then you can be anywhere in the world and listen to it. Television is good. There's a lot of regionalization on the island for newspapers. So if you're having an event that's not geographically located within certain boundaries, quite often you don't get any coverage, so you have to concentrate on other areas. The social media, we're of course using the Facebooks, and we don't use Twitter right now, but we use Facebook, and now we're starting to see people buying the iPads and things like that, so there's consideration about building apps and signing a mailing list, like signing people up to keep them up to date with what's going on, who you've booked for the festival this year.
Right,
that kind
right.
of thing.
Why not Twitter? Is it a conscious choice?
I think it's just a manpower situation we have. I'm kind of busy, and the office administrator is busy as well. So if we had a deeper pool and a larger membership, we could probably pull. That would be a good volunteer job to keep things going.
Yeah, it's certainly one of the challenges of social media is that it is it's an immense time eater,
mm-hmm.
and it's a little it's never ending, right? You can.
And the other thing about the Folk Guild is we produce other events as well, not just the folk festival. So we have 2 to 3 other events per month. So we're either promoting one or closing one off and leapfrogging to another one. So we're constantly using that form of leapfrog media to promote a new event coming along down the line.
Right. So for listeners that don't know, what are some of the events? I know you do the coffee house.
We have a monthly coffee house that runs 10 months of the year. The only July and August we don't have one. We have a youth development program, which is called Youth Jammers, that invites younger kids into a non-alcoholic environment, peer environment to play and jam with mm-hmm. each other. And then we have a chapel concert series at Providence Farm where we bring in some pretty talented people to play in that wonderful acoustic venue at the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And
you've actually called that a house concert series as well. You use that a little bit interchangeably.
Yeah, interchangeable. We were going to move it to a different location, but it didn't work out, so we went back to the chapel. But that's okay because the acoustics are fantastic in there anyway.
Yeah, they are. Who, just so listeners know, who do you have coming up in February, for example?
And Ken Ham, famous Canadian blues guitarist, Ken Ham in February. And in March we have David Sinclair, who, if you don't know who he is, look him up on the internet because he's one of the top 10 guitar players in Canada. And all kinds of special stuff coming up.
So I'm sure that this is inspiring many people out there to want to help in this, because there are, the Cowichan and Folk Guild is a fabulous organization, and there's so many ways to get involved, and as listeners hear, lots of room for volunteers. Mm-hmm. How can they get involved?
Just go to folkfest.bc.ca, that's our website. Tell us what you'd like to do with the festival, or if you'd like to help out, if you'd like to become a member of the Folk Guild, then we put you into our membership list and you get all the updates and all the requests for help as we move toward the festival.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, I wish you success on this summer's festival. Do you already have some names booked? Do you want to give us a little teaser?
Yeah, I got some fabulous people coming this year. If you're an old hippie back in the 60s, you will remember a guy named Sean Phillips, who was a fabulous guitar player. And Sean hasn't been playing around this area for years, and he's kind of a legend in his era, and he's coming back out, which is fantastic. We have Tim Williams coming, who's a wonderful blues player. Ray Bonneville coming from Austin, Texas, all the way up to play for us. So there's some pretty special things, and a lot more to come.
Fabulous. And the dates, July?
July 22, 23, 24.
Great. And, of course, you can buy early tickets now.
Yeah, I'd buy them now, actually, because it's like $75 for an entire festival right now. And the early bird price is $75 per adult.
Fabulous. Robert, thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. Hope to help.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great pleasure. We are going to move now into the next segment of Books and Bites.
You're listening to Be the Media on CHLY 101.7 in Nanaimo with Marion Vanderzon, Neil Scobie, and I'm Joy Googler for Books and Bites. Today I'm talking to VIU's third-year digital media student, Michael Price, about the evolution of e-books. In our pre-recorded interview, we surveyed the electronic landscape, from iPads to Kindles, the Kobo to the Nook. To take us there, here are The Strokes with Electricityscape.
Perfect. Particularly in the last two or three, we've seen the experimentation on e-books kind of hit its stride, particularly, I suppose, with the development of the iPad and Mac's release of that new technology for books, among many other things, as the commercials tell us. So how does that print-to-e-book trajectory reflect what you've learned?
I spoke to a girl, a friend of mine in Saskatchewan, who's a librarian and who reads all the time. And I said, are you ever going to, buy an iPad and download books? And she said, I don't want to. I like the idea of just having a book. There's something about it that I really like. So there are people like that who are just not interested in it. It's not the same to them. It's a different practice to them. And they like what they like. And my parents are both the same way. They read all the time, and they're not, my mom and dad aren't about to go buy an iPad, just to read whatever book they're reading. So there's people like that, but then there are people like me who think it's a great idea. If I could, I would buy everything as an e-book, all my textbooks and everything, and then not have to carry around six textbooks every day.
So do you think it is a generational preference, or do you think it's a function of genre? So that with nonfiction, textbooks being a perfect example for students, you can get high volume, they're cheaper, they're more portable, you can carry a lot around on an iPad or a Nook or a Kobo reader or the Kindle that you wouldn't have to carry in your knapsack or if you're traveling. So it's appealing because you've also got a search function for nonfiction, so you can quickly find what you're after rather than necessarily reading linearly front to back in a book to find what you're searching for. Do those advantages appeal more to the sort of Generation Y, Generation X, the sort of the net gen, do you think? And that's why we're seeing pick up with that age group as opposed to our parents and our grandparents?
Yeah, broadly speaking, I think it does. There are parents out there who enjoy getting their iPod and playing around with it, but for the most part, it is a generational thing. It is younger people, the net genners who want technology like this, who love it, and it fits their life. It's a normal practice for them. They're already syncing their iPod with music. Why not put books on it, too? So your parents don't probably think that way, though. Your parents think, well, I've got my iPod for my music, or that's assuming they have an iPod. I've got my iPod for my music, and I've got my book for my reading, and they're two totally separate things. They don't involve each other in any way. So it is partly a generational thing, I think.
The other thing I guess we're seeing as the years go by and publishers enter the marketplace, admittedly late, but entering it with fuller force, we're seeing improvements in the variety of ebooks, the quality of ebooks, and their suitability to these four or five key readers that are on the marketplace. And we're also seeing improvements to the technology of the reader itself, better screens, less glare in the sunlight, a little bit lighter, perhaps more versatility in terms of it feeling like a book, the way the pages turn, those kinds of things. Do you agree with the statistics that we might see 30 to 50% of book purchases be e-books within the next 3 to 5 years?
It could be true, yes. And I wouldn't be surprised if it was. And it would be a good way to get younger people to read. It would be an easy way, well, an easier way to get, younger kids to want to read. But there are books that are never going to be digitized, historical texts and, some, historical religious texts. They're never going to be digitized. Nobody's going to. And there's no need for them to be. So there are always going to be paper books, I think.
And just returning to that genre question, about 30% of publishing is fiction. And the most sort of adamant naysayers for ebooks seem to be those who primarily read literature, whether it be traditional kind of literary fiction or genre fiction, science fiction, westerns, romances, thrillers, mysteries, people who want to immerse in the text in a way that maybe holding technology doesn't allow. Do you think that that it's a different kind of reading experience, fiction to nonfiction, and that this technology just underscores that?
Yeah, I think it absolutely is. I think you're absolutely right. I think that nonfiction works well on these devices. You know, historical doesn't really. You know, it's neither here nor there to some people.
Some people are just early adopters, no matter what the technology. They just like the sexiness of it. And I suppose if reading becomes sexier because the technology for it does, that's an upside to the whole project, particularly for teachers and parents who might be trying to get that to happen for preteens and teenagers in particular. What's your own preference? Would you go out tomorrow by a reader? If so, which reader? And what would be the first kind of book or title that you'd put on it?
It's easier to actually read the book with the iBooks app rather than the Kindle app. So I would pick the iPad just because of the iBooks. Although the iBookstore doesn't have that many books in it right now. There's stuff you can't find, but you can in the Kindle store, so you kind of need both. But I think with time, the iBooks is going to be the one I would want.
And Google is certainly helping to digitize books and get more of them in that format, not only public domain books, but books for which they now have legal permission to scan and make available. And you can, you know, test them the way you would in a bookstore and read the first few pages, or you can download the whole book. But publishers have struggled with what it really means to create an ebook. A lot of times they'll just have a digital file and dump it into a format that looks book-esque, and off they go, and they haven't really investigated and invested in making the book beautiful, making the reading experience parallel to the one you would have in print, making the illustrations as gorgeous as they might be on paper, you know, adapting to the nonlinear reader who's going to go madly off in all directions if they want to check a definition or click on a link that's going to take them temporarily out of the book and into some other sort of psychic universe and then come back again. So, and it's largely because a lot of publishers, you know, are in their 50s and 60s who are making this decision and maybe haven't grown up in the online world, whereas the readership and the audience that they're creating for have, and so they have higher standards. Do you think we'll see a real improvement in ebooks, and what do you think is the next step in that direction?
I think we are going to see a lot of improvement in e-readers in the hardware in the next few years, just because I think the iPad is quite a bit further ahead than things like the Kobo and the Kindle and things like that. So I think they're kind of playing catch up right now. They've got to come out with, you know, they have the low glare fake paper screens and things like that, but they still aren't as good as the iPad. So I think they're going to have to get color. They're going to have to get, you know, better resolution and things like that. And then you'll have to, the technology will, the competition will do the same as the cameras. The competition between the companies will push the medium forward.
And as you say, maybe we'll see a combination with audiobooks where we're having some of that, some of the literature or text actually read to us. That's happening with children's books and the leapfrog kind of scenario where you can learn the language and have it read to you and you repeat it. Obviously, you wouldn't do that for adult readers, but there may be some equivalent where we're going to be able to hear the music that's in the scene that we're reading, or we're going to be able to have some sort of visual there that's simultaneous to the text that is animated and is therefore attractive. I guess it's a brave new world. We'll see what happens. When somebody said, oh, I would never, ever buy one of these, do you get into the politics of it, or do you just let them
be? I just let them go. You know, it's the same people who said at first, oh, I'm never going to buy a digital camera because the pictures are grainy. Well, the pictures are going to get better. You know, it's going to improve. It's going to become more like reading a book than it is right now, and they'll do that simply to get those people. You know, it'll be, if they make it easy enough and they make it realistic enough, maybe my mom is going to buy an e-reader. You know, so it's basically up to the hardware makers who they want to aim it at and who they want.
In addition to the sort of philosophical politics of it, there's also the big box politics, right? We've got Barnes & Noble versus Amazon, which is a head-to-head clash in terms of retailers at the moment. Amazon has a distinct lead. Kobo's kind of come out of nowhere. It doesn't have a brick-and-mortar store that it sells in like Amazon, but it specializes only in e-books, whereas Amazon sells just about everything from your washing machine to your shoes to your movies. And what about and then the iPad, of course, does many other things besides host books. So it's a multifunction, but it doesn't have a bookstore behind it. It's an interesting marketplace. Do you foresee one of those four technologies taking a distinct lead?
I think the iPad has the lead technology-wise, but it doesn't have the lead price-wise. I think the competitors, you know, the Kindle and the Kobo is designed to be a little bit more economical. But I think the Kindle needs to improve its technology and lower its price. And then you're going to see a bit more of a competition between it and the iPad, which has the lead right now but costs three times the amount.
But it's so much sexier.
Yeah.
Because the Kindle is an ugly piece of heavy, clunky hardware that
yes,
looks like a remote control for some sort of Star Trek holodeck. It's not very sleek, and it doesn't make you feel like you want to sort of be a conspicuous reader on the metro with something like that.
That's right, yeah. And it, yeah, weighs a ton, so.
And the iPad's going to cost you $500, though the new one is, you know, out shortly, so I guess the bottom line is watch and learn and see if it suits your sensibility.
That's right. When the iPad gets to its, you know, third, fourth generation, it's going to be a pretty cool device. It's going to be difficult for the other companies to compete with it, but they're going to have to if they want to survive.
And it'll probably come down in price and be thinner and maybe a little bit more like something you would hold at the beach or in the bathtub. I heard they were doing a completely waterproof iPad so that you could read in the bathtub.
Really? I saw these things that looked like a fancy Ziploc bag that you put your iPad in, and you can take it to the beach or in the bathtub with you.
Well, that's the last frontier. Thanks very much, Mike, for coming and joining us in the studio and talking about your research at VIU, as we look forward to having you back when the marketplace changes and see what you think about your predictions.
Excellent. Well, thank you.
Smell the drink of my blood. That was Arcade Fire with Ready to Start. It's getting a lot of radio play these days, but it's an appropriate song given the fact that many listeners out there might be ready to start reading some e-books and taking the plunge on an iPad, a Kindle, a Kobo, or the Nook. I think there's a Sony reader out there as well, and publishers might be finally ready to start making them.
Thanks so much, Joy. Next up, we have further excerpts from The Oral Machine by Robin Davies. And once again, this is CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo.
We are pleased to present further excerpts from The Oral Machine.
We are getting around to the idea of noticing that we have a total environment which is necessarily acoustic.
The sound was enormous, almost certainly the greatest sound ever experienced by man on the face of the earth.
Part 12. Big Bang.
All that noise, and all that sound. All those places I got found. Birds go flying at the speed of sound, to show you how it all began.
Sound travels at approximately 330 meters per second, which is pretty fast. However, man has been able to beat this speed and break the sound barrier with supersonic travel. Isn't that amazing? The reason why this occurs is because as the plane travels through the air, it pushes the air out of the way, which creates pressure waves that travel at the speed of sound. This is similar to the waves created by the bow and stern of a boat as it moves through the water. As the plane approaches the sound barrier, the air cannot get out of the way quick enough, and it is squashed together into one big shock wave that is travelling at the speed of sound. This shock wave begins at the nose of the plane and ends at the tail in steady flight. It forms a kind of cone shape that surrounds the plane, as can be seen here. The pressure inside the cone is not that much greater than normal air pressure. However, since this overpressure is released very quickly, it is audible as a sonic boom. Have a listen to one. There are actually two booms that are produced, one at the nose and one at the tail. However, they usually pass over observers almost at the same time, and so most people will only hear one. It's not just fighter jets that can produce a sonic boom. Perhaps the most famous form of transport that could break the sound barrier was Concorde, which was a commercial airliner before it was put out of use in 2003.
Before the virus messed up and gender fenced off tutu stupors. Paint for some pain and rest rain on its way down to melted kitchen. Hitched up with two twin stitches. Left unlisted like mass fritterfiskers. Live in walk, sidewalk, box, snap stocks. F***ing loudly snoop through walls down the hall from tallout or fallout. Shelter boy, girl, crypt keeper. Jaw gaping, dumbfounded and rounded up, hounded. Like a curse after who mashed up burial mounds and spit on God's fiddle horse. Traylock licking strips, and what is great, and what is made to slay fate, made for no taste test, but keep the feelers out like Miller.
Here are a few words from Mark Whittle.
The next few pages take us on a remarkable journey, far into space and far back in time, to an era when everything was different. There were no stars or galaxies, no planets or people. Not even atoms were yet fully formed. At that time, the newborn universe was pristine and formless, a brilliant expanding fireball of light and matter. And yet within that sea of brilliance, the seeds for all that we now know were already present, latent, waiting to unfold. Most remarkable of all, perhaps, these seeds were sounds, pressure waves coursing through the fluid. A symphony of sorts, though not one that we would recognize as music. This symphony had three movements, each with its own form and character. The final movement built to a unique crescendo, unlike any other before or since. Its final cacophonous chord dissolved to become the first generation of stars, whose light brought to a close the universe's first cold dark night with a new dawn.
Now, the first thing that we're going to talk about is the fact that we can see him swing the golf club, but the sound takes a certain amount of time to get there. Now, I've got the editing software that lets me edit the video, and of course, there's a time stamp on it. And when I do that, I find that the time it took for sound to travel was 0.753 seconds. And you could do it yourself with a stopwatch if you could turn the volume up enough so you could hear it. We know that the speed of sound is a constant at that temperature, and it's about 344 meters per second.
Experts in the field have taken many a stab at explaining why this might be. Some point out that the behavior of sound waves in the upper and lower atmospheres is very different, and in the speeding up and slowing down that any wave experiences on passing through them, there may be a focus-like phenomenon brought into play which would make one locality receive a lot of sound and another very little. Others, less sophisticated, explain it by reminding us how snowfall muffles sound and that ash falls, which covered Batavia and its suburbs at the time, are likely to do very much the same. Nevertheless, the overall conclusion remains inescapable, both to historical anecdote and to science. The sound that was generated by the explosion of Krakatoa was enormous, almost certainly the greatest sound ever experienced by man on the face of the Earth. No man-made explosion certainly can begin to rival the sound of Krakatoa, not even those made at the height of the Cold War's atomic testing years. Those other volcanoes that have exploded catastrophically in the years since decibel meters were invented, Mount St. Helens, Pinatubo, Unzen, Mayon, haven't come close. No one suggests that the explosion of Mount St. Helens in May 1980 was heard much beyond the very mountain ranges in which it was sighted. Dr. Verbeek, with the modest but assured prescience of one who had seen and heard and experienced the vastness of the eruption, stated in his report of 1885 that the exceptionally loud noises require our attention, the large explosions that in loudness have far exceeded all known noises. At no earlier event was a noise heard over such a large part of the Earth's surface. 13% of the Earth's surface vibrated audibly under the impact of Krakatoa's explosion, and millions who lived there heard it, and when told what it was, were amazed.
Welcome back to Be the Media. This is Neil Scobie. And earlier on in the episode, Marion was interviewing Robert McCordy, artist director for the Cowichan Folk Guild. And one of the artists that Robert mentioned that will be performing upcoming at the February Cowichan Folk Guild Coffee House is Ken Ham. And we're going to leave you today with Ken's song, Fair and Square, from the album Cross the River. Before we do, though, I'd like to thank you for listening to Be the Media. Don't forget to check us out on our podcasts. Go to chly.ca and find us in the podcast list under Be the Media, and you'll see all our shows there. Special thanks to all our contributors today, Robert McCordy, Robin Davies, Joy Googler, Marion Vanderzon, and I'm Neil Scobie. Thanks again for listening to Be the Media on CHLY 101.7.
When Suksy came to town, he didn't even have to look around. There was trouble everywhere. Trouble of the coolest kind. Make you want to grab your brother and change his mind. Walk him on the way to fair and square. Way to fair and square. Do you know it? Way to fair and square. Can you show now that summer was gone? Well, you could see winter was coming on. Watch those birch turn yellow round the bay. And with so little work around, we all were bush camp bound to a dirty deal and a minimum of pay. I know how people change. Caught in plenty, caught in gain. Caught in selling other people's lives. Caught in a deadly trap. A deadly loop that circles back. Standing in the way of fair and square. The way to fair and square. Do you know? Fair and square, can you show it? It was a Saturday social ball down at the Barton Fisher home. People came to socialize and dance. But before the evening passed, our suits he met his cast. Someone had to organize the camps. Cause to the camps along the track, well, it was easy in but part or back. And so look out to the shores of Thunder Bay. And as the early snow fell light and the frost began to bite, all new for the winter. Ah, but Altamaki had a plan, and he knew that Suksie was his man. He sent him like some bullet through the air. Yes, and how those bullets flew, and Suksie marched out from the Sioux, marching on the way. Fair and square, do you know it? Way to fair and square, can you show it? Can you show it?
Be the Media is brought to you by the Media Studies Department and the Media Research Lab at VIU.
How does that grab you?